episode of Reverse Threat Radio. I'm Andy Ryan.
And I'm Debbie Chad.
And as the rest of the world was fixated on the Ashes, welcome to the only cricket podcast that instead decided to take a holiday.
So I've been in France for a bit, you've been in Morocco and in Germany.
And I'm still managing to follow the Ashes fairly intently.
We've managed between us to go to countries that exclusively avoid cricket. Although, fun fact of the day, the only time that the cricket was ever in the Olympics, it was won by France.
That is not a bad fact at all.
I might be wrong, but I think that's true. Don't hold us to that.
So the fun and possibly incorrect fact of the day. I managed to track down probably the only place in Morocco that you could show cricket. And I tracked it down at the perfect time, which was in Ashton Agar's sort of knockaround. And a lot of Moroccan men sort of stared with utter
curiosity.
When you
say an Ashton Agar knockaround, do you mean the Ashton Agar knockaround? Because I think it's become quite apparent to most of us that his 95 is the exception rather than the rule, or 98 or whatever. Anyway, one of the things that I've loved since getting back to the UK is the fact that kind of the Ashes is everywhere. And I was quite inspired by the fact that Richard Dawkins, of all people, the great atheist thinker, had been weighing in on the debate about Stuart Broad and whether he should have walked when that massive edge occurred at Trent Bridge.
It's a series where everyone gets thrown in. It's the kind of thing where everyone's suddenly a cricket fan, everyone's got an opinion, and actually a lot of people suddenly feel very passionately.
They do, and a lot of the... what's been quite fun as well is the fact that a lot of ex-players have come back and kind of wade into the mix as well, and everyone's, you know,
and you
got their
the
columns
point.
Here and there. And
you were making the point that quite a few of the ex-players aren't holding back.
No, they're really not. I mean, Flintoff's definitely not holding back. Alan Border, in a really interesting piece today on Crick Info, actually. Alan Border, who's usually quite reserved in his opinions, just comes out and just says, of the Australian ball, we have just got Shane Watson completely wrong, and we need, you know, what are we doing? And I quite like the fact that, you know, suddenly cricket is all there. I mean, you know, in 2005 it was all over the front pages, in 2013 it's also all over the front pages, but for very, very different reasons.
Well, I think the nice thing is, and lots of people noted this in advance, but you've got this lovely break in that the football season is, for once, you know, cricket is always fighting this losing battle, frankly, with the British media's obsession with football in all forms. And we've got no major tournaments this year. Mm. And the cricket is really benefiting from that. And it is great to see. I mean, I think the hilarity of someone like Richard Dawkins getting involved is a particular sort of highlight.
And also, I mean, his argument, the thing that caught my eye was this argument of his that... if you nick someone's wallet and a policeman doesn't see, it doesn't make it right. Which apparently is a good analogy for a batsman not walking if they're out, which seems to me absolutely absurd for a number of reasons that we probably don't need to go into at this time. But anyway, I thought it was quite interesting that the ethical dilemmas of cricket seem to be so important that everyone's getting up. Anyway, have you actually seen any this summer?
Have I seen any cricket?
Yeah, any cricket.
I have. Well, God, compared to last summer was the summer of eternal cricketing failure, in that every time I either booked tickets or managed... I mean, we went together on several...
You scored a five at some point, didn't you?
Well, yeah. No, I mean, do you not remember our trip to Rainy Hove last year? We made several
miserable
failures.
Miserable.
Slightly more successful this year. Saw the T20 at the Oval, Surrey Essex game. And it made me realise that we worry a lot in England about has T20 found its place in this country? You know, we haven't got our IPL, we haven't even got our BBL. And I went to this
already
game...
Or any other acronym.
No, and I went to this game, you had 12,000 packed into the Oval on a Wednesday night, you know, a midweek evening, and I suddenly realised that T20 in this country is doing exactly what it's supposed to. You had all these people who had left work, come straight to the game with their friends. They were having a couple of drinks and they were enjoying a really engaging game. I mean, it helped that this was a really good game. There were lots of great players on show. It was a really good contest and the atmosphere was great. I mean, I'm not averse to a nice, sleepy county championship afternoon where half the audience is reading the crossword and the other half is asleep. But this was fun. You know, there's a real buzz, there was a real hum out there. I went with a couple of people who, if are not, I would say, great fans of the game, and they all got very engaged with it, and it was great fun. Mm.
Well, I was at the Oval as well at a different game last Friday, which was Surrey Middlesex, and actually, I mean, people who listen to the podcast frequently might have clocked the fact that I'm not a massive fan of the 2020 form of the game. And actually, I thought while I was there, I mean, by the... It wasn't a very good game, and by the 15th over, it was pretty clear that... Hampshire. That Hampshire were going to win. Actually, I became more interested in the whatever you call them when you stack up all the beer glasses in the stand. And
a beer snake.
That's it.
Also, worthy of a diversion here, those plastic devices used to hold six beer cups simultaneously. I'd never really had faith in them until my tea time.
They are brilliant. I'm amazed by them. I am constantly.
And you can even hold them precariously over people's heads.
And they never really smell as well. No. I mean, the person who invented that should be given a medal
of
some sort.
I'd like to think they're making a lot of money out of it. I hope so.
Well, the real reason I was going to that. Well, I was going to that T20 last Friday at the Oval for two reasons. Firstly, to take a couple of friends of mine who've never seen a cricket game before, and secondly, to see Ricky Ponting bat. I've seen him once before in 2009 in the one day that followed the Ashes, or were they before the Ashes? No, I think they were after the Ashes then. At Lord's, when England, Adil Rashid completely lost his length and England got hammered. And I thought, well, this is the last opportunity I'm going to have to see him, obviously. And it turned into a bit of a farce, really, because before the game they had this, you know, they presented him with his county cap and there were all these fireworks and flamethrower. Why on earth you need a flamethrower when it's 32 degrees? I don't know, but they did. And all kinds of kind of razzmatazz and fun and games. And he might as well have been at the IPL, frankly. And then, of course, he comes in and he makes about three and then spoons a catch to cover. And I just... Kind of 2020 is a bit of a ruthless game sometimes in that sense. It doesn't allow... You know, it's actually a bit of a leveller. In that sense,
I think it's that unfortunate thing, and I think it's happened to all of us, where you go to a game wanting to watch a particular batsman, and cricket's very cruel in that regard. I mean, if you go to a football game wanting to watch a particular player, they might play terribly, but you at least see them play. You go to watch a particular batsman, it'll often last 2 minutes, and that'll be that.
Now, enough of this 2020 lark, because if circumstances had been different, we wouldn't be here now.
So it's not. We'd gone through the whole palaver. In fact, my brother had gone through the whole palaver of trying to get Ashes tickets, and it ended up with a few tickets for the fifth day at Lord's. And Toby and I had obviously taken these up. And early stages, I was fairly confident. I thought, you know, Lord's generally produce a pretty good batting track. You know, there's a good chance we'll get at least, you know, two-thirds of a day, half
Shane
a day.
Watson won't get out LBW for 35. I mean, we were thinking realistically at this stage.
And I was thinking, you know, maybe, fingers crossed, we might even get a gripping finish. We might have a real memorable day.
We wanted another Trent Bridge, basically.
And normally, I'm very happy with cricket's various idiosyncrasies, from, you know, an obsession with cloud cover to the fact that you can play an intense game for 5 days and end with no result. I'm always very happy with that. But I have to say, having tickets for the fifth day has completely spoiled my enjoyment of the second test. My obsession became, will it go 5 days? And the hatred I felt for the Australian batting lineup when they crumbled to 90-odd for seven in the second test, I thought, you aren't actually just losing this game, you are destroying my Monday.
They're doing it to spite us. And actually, yesterday afternoon, I was kind of willing the last Australian batsman to get out because I didn't want to have the dilemma of thinking, there are two wickets in hand, do we go down to Lord's and watch it just to see an England victory? Is it actually worth it? And actually, more than that, you always end up on, when you're on one of these days where it's clear it's going to end soon, of thinking, okay, if there's more than 10 overs, then we don't get a refund. And usually, I mean, I've been to a game actually at Lord's where it went on for 10.1 overs, a miserable 10.1 overs, and you don't get any money back, which is when you've shelled out, you know, 40 quid a ticket or something, it's quite significant.
So we enjoy the absurdities of cricket, except when we're on the receiving end. From the archives, and as Joe Root celebrates his landmark innings, Toby's going to pay homage to the man who could have been opening at Lord's.
So, Nick Compton, he's kind of a name that we might have forgotten about by now. But I was reminded of him by a little tweet he sent on Saturday evening after the close of play on the day that Joe Root had made his century, in which he said, and I quote, "Well played, Joe Root, excellent effort and well deserved, pal." Sorry, I didn't mean to put emphasis on the pal there. But I thought this was an act of kind of extraordinary graciousness from a man who I think many people would agree has been pretty hard done by. by the English setup. Not least because usually actually Twitter in the 21st century, and particularly in the last 3 weeks, has been a means for people to snipe from the sidelines. I'm sure you've all seen, I mean, it's not really related, but it's quite amusing. I'm sure you've all seen David Warner's brother Stephen describing Mickey Arthur as an escape goat now trending across the world. And indeed, Cricket Australia's wonderful claim that they're expletive about the bell catch that wasn't given didn't, quote, emanate from Cricket Australia's official presence.
So this
I like the idea of tweets emanating from an official presence. The tweets emanate from your official presence. It's like the bloody royal we, isn't it?
It's sufficiently vague to give you no idea of what exactly they're claiming happened. But I suppose this is a rare tweet that was used for kind of good means, a sort of a good end. It's an odd question, I guess, whether, when you're dropped for another player, how personally you take it, really. And it seems in this case, much to Nick Compton's credit, he really hasn't taken it personally.
No, and actually, I mean, Nick Compton's omission from the England squad has been one of the kind of intriguing subplots of the summer. And the selectors seem to, having selected Compton in India and then for both series against New Zealand, seem to have sort of rode back on a plan that they'd had for a while after Compton's back-to-back failures in those matches against New Zealand. In England, and actually, I wonder whether it sort of slightly has something to do with the different styles of cricketer that Joe Root and Nick Compton are. And I'm not saying it's necessarily a face-off between the two, but I think they do represent two very different schools of cricketers. So Nick Compton, I mean, his style of batting is certainly something of days gone by, in a sense. He's more Len Hutton than Michael Vaughan. He wouldn't probably have been hitting those two sixes as Joe Root did late on Saturday afternoon. And his batting is kind of based around the central premise that the primary function of an opener is not to get out. And secondly, and perhaps a more important difference, is that Compton's career has been based around county cricket, essentially. He had proved himself in county cricket. He began life at Middlesex, where he was the top run scorer in 2009. And in October 2009, the summer after he'd been top run scorer, he came out and just said, "I need a new challenge," and moved off to Somerset, who welcomed him with open arms. And on the other hand, Joe Root is very much of the school of the New England cricketer who come through the academy, who then go through the Lions, and who then move on to England.
And sort of have a kind of small a kind of relatively brief initiation in county cricket. I mean, I'm thinking on those lines, sort of Stuart Broad very much fits that mould, where they come through, that, you know, they play a bit of county cricket to bring them in, but actually, they hardly have a kind of long building, growing period.
Well, for instance, Compton had played first class cricket for 8 years before being picked for England, and he made his England debut at age 29. Joe Root made his first class debut in 2010 and was in the England team by 2012 at the age of 21. And that shows you the difference in the way that they've been kind of fast tracked between one and the other.
And I suppose it was part of the reason why I think Compton's selection was seen originally as very, very well deserved. You know, he'd really earned it, he'd done the hard work. And frankly, he'd just scored a shitload of runs over a very long period of time. And
Compton's average, he topped the county averages in 2012 with an average of, I think, 99.95 or something like that across the county season, which is pretty interesting. But also, I found it very interesting that when, after the New Zealand games in England, that Andy Flower said to Compton, "Go back to your county, go back to Somerset and score runs." And it actually made me think, what would have happened if someone like Alistair Cook had gone out of form? Because I suspect it wouldn't have been quite the same. I suspect it would have been, you know, yes, go back to your county and get some time under your belt, but also go to the ECB Performance Centre in Loughborough and have, you know, Graham Gooch doing throwdowns at you for six weeks solidly. And I just think it shows a kind of difference in the mentality of two different schools of cricketers, one of which has its grounds in the ECB performance kind of schedule, as it were, and then the other one, which has its roots in county.
More sort of sure. And to be fair, Compton may have responded well and been very generous to Root, but he did come out with a comment a few weeks ago that he didn't feel his dropping was particularly fair. Because ultimately they sent him back to County Cricket to make some runs, and he did make some runs. Actually, he made some runs against the Australian attack.
And he said after when the news broke that he wasn't in the Trent Bridge squad, he said, "I don't really know where things stand, to be honest. I got told I'd been dropped. Your guess is as good as mine. Would you drop me for an Essex warm-up game and then pick me? Isn't that messing a few people around? I don't know." And then went on to say, "I'm certainly not going to lose hope of playing in an Ashes series. It's a dream of mine. It's been disappointing of late, but I'll keep fighting because I regard myself as a fighter. I feel ready, but it's not my job to select." And I just get... okay, so do you think he's ever going to play for England again?
I think the difficulty he has is that there is this natural instinct, I think, to blood the new players. You know, it's this natural instinct to build for the future. And I think particularly there's now talk that James Taylor may possibly come in if Kevin Peterson's certainly not fit for the next test. And it would suggest that England selects, and there's obviously a good argument for it, are looking to bring through the young players. I think where that is sometimes unfair is that there is a lot to be said, I think always, for this basic principle of getting your strongest 11 on the pitch, frankly. And if you're good enough, the age, I don't think it should be a huge issue.
But I wonder as well whether there's a sense in which the England setup kind of know what they like.
Mm.
And they like to think that if a player has been controlled from quite an early age through going through the ECB kind of official systems, they know what they're dealing with. Yeah. Whereas they don't really, if someone's been off playing for counties. And I get the sense that the ties between counties and the central setup aren't as close as they once were. So it's not as if there's a kind of real camaraderie between the coaches where they're kind of all acting as one.
I wonder if the other problem that Compton's got, and this is interesting when you contrasted, say, him and Root, is the fact that actually, when Compton failed, he looked horrible. You know, he's a player that, because his game is very defensive and built in that sort of old-fashioned don't give it away opener, which, by the way, I think there's still a key role for in the game, he looked so out of sorts because he's not going by playing sort of, you know, expansive drives and expansive shots. He's going looking sort of very over-intelligent. I suppose on the plus side, he has his dream of playing in the Ashes is perhaps helped by the fact that he's got these, you know, slightly improbable 10 consecutive tests in which to force his way into the reckoning.
As well as actually some very good performances against the Australians before the series started in the counter game. But what's interesting is that, I mean, obviously this desire to play for England is now sort of on the table and that he's working towards it. But I think it's interesting that for a man who left Middlesex because he kind of said, "I've done it all here now that I've topped the averages," it'll be interesting to see what the next challenge is. To the book review, and this episode in the spirit of Ashes Fever, we have been reading Jarrod Kimber's When Freddie Became Jesus on the 2009 Ashes. Jarrod Kimber, who I think first came to both of our attentions as the author of the brilliant cricketwithballs.com blog, and since has become slightly more part of the establishment as one of the writers on a regular on Crick Info.
If you're not familiar with Kimber's sort of direct comic style, let's start off with a quote. This is him describing the Australian claps at Lord's in the second test. "What are we supposed to tell the children? Daddy, I don't understand. How did we lose to England? Well, my son, you see, they all decided to play the hook and pull shots very badly on one day. Daddy, that's fucked. Can we kill them?" Which makes it pretty clear to you that this is not your kind of traditional cricket writer. And the first thing to say about When Freddie Became Jesus, which would be no surprise to any reader of cricketwithballs.com or Jarrod's work on Crick Info, is it's very, very funny. And I think comic writing often gets seen as sort of like a lesser art. But the point about comic writing is that for things to be funny, they have to have a grain of truth in them. And this is the thing that makes this book so successful, I think, is that combination of being comic and being spot on.
And it also means that I think for the kind of the average fan, Kimber is relating an experience that we know about. Sometimes, you know, when you read Atherton in the Times, his account of, you know, of a match, for instance, it's kind of, he's trying to give equal weight to everything. With Kimber, you really get the sense of it coming from the perspective of someone who's sitting there living through it. And there were so many moments reading this. I mean, 2009 is one of the highlights box sets that I don't actually have, and so I haven't kind of interacted with it as a series.
It's not really a highlight
but
now, series, is it? In
but,
a lot
but,
of ways.
But now, well, come on, the last stand at Cardiff is surely the stuff that we can all watch hundreds of times. But yeah, as I say, having it from a fan's perspective, there are so many moments that wouldn't necessarily come across in kind of official accounts that suddenly I was thinking, yes, I remember
that. That's a great moment. I think the other thing is, having introduced him as someone who's very different in his writing style, and he certainly is, there's aspects about his writing which are actually very much like the kind of great cricket writers, in that he just has a great flair for language. I love the fact that when Andrew Strauss scores runs, he scores them with the authority of a wing commander. And I enjoyed the fact that Jonathan Trott wasn't just comfortable, he was obscenely comfortable. You know, it's that flair for language, that enjoyment of language that brings the game to life, and I think the Kimber's extremely strong.
And there are so many. I mean, we were discussing just now what quotation you read out to summarise the style, and there are just so many. I mean, there's a brilliant one that we won't spoil it for you, but buy the book. Jared, give us some royalties, we'll take 10%. Buy the book and then read the quotation on the back.
Involves a naked Ian Bell.
In a birdcage. It's brilliant. It's the kind of thing you just read and you identify with straight away.
And I think you're right, and certainly a lot of fans who perhaps wouldn't relate to more kind of certain types of cricket writing instantly relate to. And Kimber is, in the best possible way, approaching the 2009 Ashes series as kind of an outsider. You know, he's a blogger who's managed, for some tests at least, to get himself into the press box and stuff. And one thing this allows him to do is to often sort of play the contrarian, I think, very effectively. His attitude to Andrew Flintoff, which I guess comes across in the When Freddie Became Jesus title, I think is absolutely spot on. He makes this point that really, the recognition that Flintoff started to receive at the grounds was bordering on delirious. There's a good example, actually, when Flintoff drops a catch, a fairly straightforward slip catch, and no one makes any comment of it. It isn't replayed on any of the grounds, isn't replayed on any of the screens. And he makes the point that I think only an outside journalist could do, of how England, frankly, just became slightly besotted, slightly delirious. Mm. But perhaps the best bit of analysis, I think, is in the fifth test, where he reads out these endless quotes from very respected journalists talking about the pitch, talking about how Australia had been done over by the pitch. And Kimber is, I think, superb in kind of just dismissing this myth and just saying, actually, where's the evidence? Is there a single dismissal in this test match that was related to the pitch? Mm. And that contrary streak in him makes him great value to read, because you want that analysis.
I think there are two other things as well that come from that kind of slightly contrarian standpoint that you're talking about. And one of them is the kind of wide-eyed wonder that you get at frequent intervals through the book. And, you know, there are just those moments in cricket when you just sit there and you just think, this is amazing. And for Kimber, that, you know, they're the same as some of us go through in the games. There are also these moments where he kind of witnesses Richie Benaud eating his lunch in the press box somewhere. And they're all the kind of moments that we can identify with. But I think also, there's a sense that he has, I mean, I mentioned in the intro that he's sort of become a part of the establishment a bit as he's come to write for Crook Info, but he occupies a really interesting middle ground between a fan and a writer. And I think you can definitely, we obviously review quite a lot of books on this podcast, and you can definitely tell the two styles apart. And often when people are fans, to be honest, they don't have a massively good grasp on the game. I mean, we probably fall into that category as well. and then on the other extreme, when you're a professional writer, you can become sort of slightly detached, actually, in a way. And I think one of the really interesting things is the way that he manages to hold both them out, to have that, as I say, that wide-eyed sense of wonder, together with a really good grasp of being able to debunk these myths about, you know, what the oval pitch is doing for spinners and everything like that.
And I think if you look at his story, and I think perhaps my only criticism of the book would be, I'd like to have a bit more on his story and how he came to get, you know, make the transition from fairly left field blogger to sort of more mainstream. And I guess part of the problem is that some of that story came post 2009, but it's kind of how the internet was supposed to work for cricket writing, in that you had someone who, through producing something independent and interesting and different to what else was out there, built up a following of fans, and actually mainstream, you know, publications like Crick Info suddenly looked at him and said, actually, we'd like a bit of that audience. And it's a good story.
Yeah. So I think two conclusions, really. Number one, buy it and read it. It's a great book and a good reminder of actually a very intriguing series. And two, Jared, if you're out there, can we have another one on 2013 as well?
This episode I spoke to Josh Green, who until very recently ran the Surrey Cricket blog. I began by asking what he thought of the current state of county cricket coverage.
Well, I guess you're never really satisfied as a county cricket fan because, you know, you'd like it to be in every single newspaper and sort of saturated as much as football is almost. But I think it has improved markedly in the last 12 months with the, you know, the BBC ball-by-ball coverage is such a massive thing because you can really access any game almost whenever you want. You know, you can sit there listening to it at your desk if you can manage to make it look like you're doing work at the same time. You know, I think in the print press, obviously, it is disappointing, but I think you have to be realistic that it's an industry that's on its way. If not on its knees, then it's not doing particularly well. So something's got to give, basically, and it is disappointing, but I think you have to be realistic about these things, and coverage is in decline, and it's probably only going to go one way. But then you have things like Crick Info, and the county coverage on Crick Info this year has been exceptional, both in terms of scale and quality. So, yeah, I think you're never quite satisfied with it, but as it stands, I think it's pretty good.
So just picking up on the BBC side of things, I've been consistently quite impressed by the quality, generally, the games I've listened to, the commentary on the games I've listened to. I mean, I wonder what your thoughts are on sort of the actual quality, how it compares to, I guess, the more, you know, the international coverage, that side of things.
Yeah, I think it's really good, actually. I think it tends to be done by people who have been covering their club or local cricket for a very long time. I mean, you only have to look at Mark Church at Surrey, who's been covering Surrey for goodness knows how long, but a very long time. So it tends to be people who really know their club inside out. And that comes through on the commentary, I think, because, you know, they know the players, if they, you know, perhaps not personally, but they are familiar with the players. And I mean, you'll be aware that not all the international commentators, perhaps they don't watch as much county cricket as we would like them to. So it's really nice that you get a bit more of a local feel, really, and, you know, you feel like they know the club a bit better. So I think it is, you know, sometimes it's a little bit kind of parochial, I suppose, but on the whole, I think the coverage is really good.
No, I mean, I really share your admiration of the Surrey team. I think they do a really superb job, and I think they combine this sort of, I guess it's not unlike TMS, and they combine this sort of quite chatty, friendly style with also some really good analysis. And I guess my thoughts on kind of the change away from news, the shift away from newspaper coverage, is that it seems to me as if a lot of match reports as a medium, that seems to be suffering to me, in that I guess looking back to kind of the heyday of cricket writing, a lot of the great journalists' day-to-day work was producing these really elegant, well-written match reports. Yeah. And that seems to be, with the papers not really focusing as much on it, that seems to be suffering. Because I guess Crick Info's focus, even though they do have the match reports day-to-day, a lot of the effort is going into the blog and the sort of the live updates.
I think that's right.
So I wondered, I mean, is that a transition you're comfortable with, or do you still think the match reports themselves deserve a lot of effort being invested in them? Or,
well, I think the problem is there's probably much less time now to craft these match reports. So a lot of, and I agree with you, I think you're right, a lot of what's on Crick Info is really kind of functional and not necessarily beautifully written, although I do think there are some very, very good writers on there. But I think you have to generate the content so quickly, it's not really, you're not able to kind of pour your heart and soul into it as much as I'm sure they would like to. But everything, in these days, everything has to be so immediate that there is less of a chance, I think, for people to really pore over the detail of stuff.
Mm. And it does seem like, I guess, how a lot of people who interact is they're more interested in that instant stuff, aren't they? That instant live text update, that instant. So I guess coming back then to where you felt coverage of county cricket was, you have run a successful blog for a while. You've chosen to sort of, I understand, sort of bring it to a close for the moment.
And I guess I wondered, a dual question, what encouraged you to start it, and now what's encouraged you to kind of wind it down?
Yeah, well, I think where it sort of sprung out of was back in 2009. There was a, it really sprung out of frustration, really, because there was a match report, I think it was after a 2020 game, and we've not been very good at 2020 for a good few years now.
Yeah.
And it was on the official website, it was written, the match report was written in a really kind of not disingenuous, but not really particularly accurate way. The way it was portrayed was like it was a brave effort by the Surrey lads, when in fact it was a total capitulation. We were roundly trounced by, I can't remember who it was, possibly Essex, I think, or maybe that's just because they've roundly trounced us recently. It was kind of infuriating that they'd glossed over the fact that we'd given away wickets and bowled absolutely horribly. So I was sort of looking around at places, at other places to get my fix of county cricket. And as you know, the coverage there is limited, I've just been discussing. So I thought, well, why not start my own blog? And I never really expected anybody to read it to begin with. But then I kind of realised that there was no other Surrey blogs out there. So it was something of a niche, I suppose. And then it just, I didn't really think to give it up until now. I think the reason I've decided to wind it down is, I recently had a 2-week summer holiday, and for the past 4 years, after my holidays, I've sort of been champing at the bit to get back to the blog, especially during the season. And so I found myself, I didn't really miss it so much. And I thought, and I've been to a couple of games since, and I was kind of dreading having to do the blog. And when it gets to that point, it kind of takes a little bit of the joy out of the cricket as well. And I never wanted it to get to that point. I always wanted it to be a pleasure to write the blog, and it was for the vast majority of the time, even though Surrey were generally not doing particularly well in that time.
And I find that as a very interesting, because I feel like blogging, there are so many cricket blogs that have, you kind of find links to them all the time, that have been started and often look really good, actually, initially, have started with good intentions. And then, yours has actually been, yours has had real endurance, hasn't it? I mean, you've built up an audience, it's gone on for years. I guess I'm talking more about blogs that have lasted really a few months kind of thing. And I think one thing that gets forgotten about it sometimes as a medium, it is how much of a demand it is, because you are single-handedly producing all this content again and again, and people are looking for new content. Do you think it was just a question of, do you think it was the fact that perhaps it was beginning to feel a bit sort of samey as such? Do you think you'd felt, I'm now, you're getting so comfortable at producing these match reports, this content, that it no longer felt new anymore? Or
I think that's right. And there's only, some very close friends of mine have always told me to try and avoid cliches. And I know that was one of the kind of major failings of my blog, is that I kept on repeating to the same old cliches. But that is really what I found in the last kind of 3 or 4 months, is that I was, there's only so much new content that you can think of when you are producing. And in the season, you kind of start to sympathise with the players when they say there's too much cricket, because in the season, once the season starts, it's almost non-stop, because if you're not doing a match review, you're doing a match preview, and then, it's match reports at the end of each day's play, and then perhaps after each game, there's a talking point, maybe, especially with Surrey, because of the things like the Graham Smith signing, the Chris Adams sacking. There's always something going on at the club, also the fact that we seem to sign a player every 2 weeks.
Well, exactly, a big name, a constant big names being churned in.
Exactly.
But did you find that, I guess, when things were, you were really enjoying the writing, do you think you got more out of watching the game when you were watching it with kind of a blogger's eye on it? Or are you now finding that you've kind of got rid of that and you're watching it as a fan, that you're actually enjoying it more? I know you're a fan in both cases, but I guess the difference between watching it with your sort of blogger hat on, or just watching it just as a casual fan out for an evening's fun?
Yeah, well, I've only very recently decided to call it a day, but I think it was... You definitely feel when you've got the blog and you're going to games when you can, because it's, there's only so many games you can go to with it when you've got a full-time job. But when you're going to games, you do feel a little bit of a responsibility to kind of take notes and really pay attention to what's actually happening on the field.
I suppose
that does get a bit draining.
Did you find, I thought your point was really interesting, that part of your inspiration came from the fact that you read that official report. And it's something I have both as a cricket fan, and I also have it very much as a football fan when I'm reading official QPR match reports. And I'm fascinated by the way the official journalist there has sort of twisted it to make any results seem respectable.
Sorry, go on.
And I just wondered kind of whether that's something you've come across again and again while you've been blogging, whether you've sort of read the kind of, because I sometimes find it watching international cricket as well, that there's almost an accepted angle that a lot of papers will trot out. And then you were there yourself and you look back and you think, that's not how I remember it. You know, that's just not what I saw.
Well, I should say, actually, to their great credit, they did that match report that inspired me to start the blog. They did actually edit that and change it, because I think they realised that it was so so inaccurate. And since then, it has been better. And I don't expect the Surrey website to be critical of the players, really, because they can't. And, you know, Mark Church is writing these reports and he has to talk to the players day in, day out. So I don't expect them to be critical of the players. But what I was sort of looking for was a bit more sort of, I want to say honesty, but that implies that they're being dishonest, which isn't strictly speaking the case, but kind of a bit more frankness with the fans, I suppose. And, you know, we're grown up. We know that, you know, sometimes things don't quite go to plan. And I think that's what people are after, because what you don't want to see when you come back from a day's play and you've watched Leicestershire rack up 600 or something, and what you don't want to see is the club website saying how wonderful, you know, how dogged a performance it was. What you want to see is a sort of, you know, frank assessment of what might have gone wrong and what might have, you know, fair enough. If you want to put what went right, that's okay. But you've got to be honest with the fans and say, you know, what we didn't do well. And they have...
Sorry, you've got a duty, haven't you, to all those fans who weren't there, right? You know, I guess the majority reading it want an honest account of what they didn't see and how the team actually did.
Yeah, that's right. That's absolutely right, yeah.
So I suppose we've got to come to all things Surrey, because of all the counties in terms of talking points, there really couldn't be more. I mean, I suppose it's not a straightforward question to ask, but it's... Most of the Surrey fans I've spoken to, there's a general feeling that the Chris Adams sacking, while a few were maybe slightly disappointed, that there was a sense that it was probably the right time in a lot of ways, that there was time for a move. I mean, have you got a sense of why it didn't work? Because the money was there, he was a very, mm-hmm. very talented guy in a lot of ways. Do you have a sense of why you think it didn't work out in the end?
Well, I think when I was thinking this over, I sort of went back right to the start of his tenure, and I think he really wasted a year at the very start, because we were such a low ebb in 2009. We were really a horrible, horrible team. It was, you know, the club looked like it was going nowhere. It was, you know, there are a lot of sort of journeyman cricketers, I suppose. And what I think should have happened is a real... effort to get the young players in from the word go. And what we actually saw in that first year in 2009 was some very average players play as many or if not more games than the youngsters. So you had people like Pedro Collins, people like Murtaza Hussain, who's, you know, completely gone off the radar, playing as many games if not more than the Surrey youngsters that were coming through. So I really think there was a year that was wasted at the start of his tenure, where, you know, and frankly, if we'd have gone through that 2009 season and won a game, I don't think anyone really, we only won one as it was, but I don't think anyone would have batted an eyelid as long as we'd been seen to be blooding youngsters. And players that were at the club then, like Aaron Harinath, and well, his case is a good one, because he's now coming good at the club when, you know, if he'd been tried and tested in that first season properly, then he could be so much further advanced in his career. And then you've got other players like Matt Spriegel, who, again, should really have been blooded in that first season more than he was.
Do you think the balance is Do you think the balance is right now in that there is clearly more faith in youngsters? I mean, Haranath and Burns at the top of the order. That they clearly, I mean, Zafar Ansari sort of playing key role in the kind of T20 side. Do you think that balance? Because at the same time, there's a lot of people out there looking at some of the Surrey purchasing, and I mean, I guess the decision to bring Ponty and these kind of things. That there still seems to be quite, and I guess players like Solanke, there still seems to be an instinctive like reaching to veterans. Or are you quite happy now that there is a balance between kind of youth seniority there?
No, not really. I think there is what we have now is a really kind of very funny looking squad, really, because you have a lot of old players, 35 plus. And a lot of, a fair number of young players, and not so many in that the sort of prime of their career. You've got Stephen Davies, who is in that slot, and Haranath to an extent, although he hasn't played as much cricket as he should have done by now. So what we don't have is that crop of players in the sort of 26 to 32, really in the prime of their careers. We just don't have them, and that will. That's not sustainable, because at the end of this season, we will lose players like, well, I don't know, but I mean, players like John Lewis and Xander De Bruyne, their contracts are up at the end of this season, and they've got to be replaced. So, and that will keep happening if you continue to sign older players. You'll keep having to renew the squad to a certain extent. So there's no quick fix, because there aren't loads of 26 to 32-year-old players out there in county cricket who are just going to be available to Surrey. But this comes back to the point I was making about Chris Adams' failure at the beginning of his tenure to really develop a new crop of players. And that's coming back to bite us now. So in short, no, I'm not really satisfied that the balance of the squad is quite right at the moment.
I wondered, sort of taking a look around kind of some rivals and competitors, whether there's a county out there that you'd look at and say, this is the way to do it. Whether, you know, there's counties out there that have got a model that you can look at and say, this is actually how I'd like to see Surrey run.
Yeah, I think when you ponder that question, it's difficult to look beyond Warwickshire, although they're not having a great time of it this season. But they do a good job of bringing through their homegrown players, but they also do a good job of signing what you might term broken players. So people like Chris Wright, not strictly speaking a broken player, but someone who sort of lost their way, but obviously had all the raw materials to succeed. And he's obviously doing very well now. I think he's out for the season with a stress fracture, but he's doing extremely well. So I think they're a good model for other counties.
This point of broken players, I think, is fascinating because, I mean, Surrey, I don't know if we've quite got time to go into it, but Surrey obviously had a horrific year last year off the field, you know, aside from on. And you look at Chris Jordan and Rory Hamilton-Brown, players of real sort of huge promise, I mean, huge talent. Does it frustrate you that they felt that they had to move on? That they felt, I guess Hamilton-Brown in particular is a special case in this regard, but that they felt that they had to go to Sussex to rebuild and find promise? And that it wasn't possible for them to be kind of improved and developed at Surrey.
Yeah, that's. I think, like you said, I don't think you can apply that logic really to Hamilton Brown because the circumstances were so extreme. But Jordan is massively frustrating because it was clear right from the start in 2007 that he was a phenomenally gifted cricketer, physically gifted, and was very talented. And he didn't succeed, sorry, and it wasn't for a shortage of chances because he did play a lot of games. He wasn't always backed in a particular role, and I think that is an issue. He was shifted up and down the batting order, for example, when he really should have been a sort of number seven, number eight. And with the ball, he was often not trusted with crucial spells. And it's very difficult from the outside to tell what went wrong with Jordan, whether it was a lack of effort on the player's part or whether it was poor coaching on the club's part. It's very difficult to tell, but from what's happened at Sussex, you would have to say that you would lean more towards it being a poor coaching effort from Surrey, because whatever Sussex have done, they've made him into a fine, fine bowler. He's, I think he's approaching 50 wickets for the season.
I think that's
he's still expensive, but he's obviously he's moved on rapidly inside 8-9 months.
I think it's a really interesting distinction you made, because I've heard a lot of people make the case, well, he got a lot of chances at Surrey, but I think it's interesting to hear your argument that actually he did get chances, but they weren't always maybe the best quality chances, and we don't know, yeah, as you said, what was going on behind the scenes. Yeah. I guess, finally, but back to yourself and your sort of your future plans, you've blogged on, you've written on Crick Info, and is mm-hmm. sort of the future, do you think that might be, you'd like to kind of keep that going, keep that side of things going?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's a good medium to get my opinions out there, which is always nice. And they're a really great bunch of writers, I think, and I like to sort of develop my skills along those lines as well. And they do appear to be moving in the right direction as regards the volume of county cricket coverage. So I definitely think that's something I keep doing if possible.
How do you see it, that building your skills? Because I find that just a really interesting point, because I think a lot of writers kind of feel, well, they've got the way they write. But how do you look to do that? How to sort of move your writing on?
I think what I would look to do now is perhaps, like what we were talking about earlier, there's what I've been doing for the past 4 months is really sort of churning out match reports and doing the odd sort of opinion piece, but what I'd really like to focus on now is to kind of find my own voice a bit more, I suppose, and write a bit more, perhaps a bit more creatively, I suppose, and not so much just reflecting on what's happened on any given day, but maybe reflecting on cricket over a longer period, perhaps, and sort of trying to develop my own voice in that way.
And finally, to the debate. Now, the first two tests of this Ashes series have generated a huge amount of DRS controversy and have kind of forced us to come back to this fairly well-debated topic. But today we're asking whether the current format of DRS is fit for purpose.
The reason that I suggested this as a debate topic was because DRS, as it is currently set up, its premise is that it should eliminate bad decisions. And yet, we have it in place, and we have Stuart Broad not out, having middled a ball to slip via a keeper. Therefore, something is most certainly wrong if that original premise that it is there to eliminate the howler simply isn't succeeding. Instead, DRS has become something that's tactical. It's something that players are good or bad at playing. And of course, how you interact with the umpires is absolutely a part of the game, but DRS hasn't become a part of umpiring. It's become a completely separate tactical decision altogether. It's changed the way that umpires have gone about their business. It's changed the way the players have gone about their business, and it hasn't actually fed into the current structure of cricket. I mean, personally, although this isn't quite what we're debating, but personally, I think there's a fundamental problem with the idea that some decisions should be treated with more scrutiny than others. I think every single decision should be treated with the same amount of scrutiny, and that actually it shouldn't be the players saying, I think this decision is important, so we're going to review it, but I don't think this one's important, so we're not going to review this one. But my more immediate problem is that DRS is having, I suppose, an impact beyond its remit, and it's become a new tactic in cricket, whereas the original intention was for it to back up umpiring. And I come back to the fact that it is clearly not working in backing up the umpire if Stuart Broad can middle a ball to slip and him not be given out.
Okay, two very, very important distinctions to make here. The first thing is, it is the easiest way to undermine the role of umpires out in the field would be to give umpires the power to refer everything. If you give umpire the powers to refer every single decision, they effectively are in a position where they should really be referring anything. I mean, if they don't refer something and they turn out to be wrong, they're going to be absolutely vilified.
No, hang on, sorry to interrupt, but that's not true, because I think we've got to stop seeing a distinction between the umpires on the field and the technology that is available to them off the field. It's kind of like saying, let's put cotton wool in their ears and they can't hear anything, they should only refer to their ears if they can't see it with their eyes.
If you get to the stage where umpires can refer every decision, then it becomes extremely difficult to argue that they should not refer almost every decision.
No, that's rubbish. Hang on. The number of decisions that are marginal are very, very small indeed.
Put it in this sort of example.
The only things that are marginal are a proportion of LBW decisions.
A very large proportion of LBW decisions.
Which are what, about 20%? 20% of dismissals in first class cricket?
Let's use an example.
That's not a majority.
Let's use an example here of something that they are already in a position with which they can always refer, which is runouts.
Yep.
Yeah. Umpires now will refer runouts that from the crowd I can see aren't out. And I know exactly why
that's
they
not
do
true.
That
is not
I know
true.
Exactly
that's
why they
not
do
true.
That.
In the last two tests, there have been runouts that they haven't referred.
I've seen from my own evidence of watching the game, I've seen evidence of umpires using that entirely legit. I understand why they're doing it, because the risk of them not referring and the decision actually being out is huge and considerable. But the problem is that, and they know the scrutiny they'll be under, but the problem is that safety first approach, if umpires had full control over the system, would actually make them nothing more than signposts in the middle of the pitch. I would actually argue, if umpires were able to refer every decision, you could almost get rid of them. You could almost have a situation where the third umpire was God and the guys in the field are pretty much just...
But I think fundamentally what we are debating is DRS at the moment, the purpose of DRS at the moment is to eliminate wrong decisions from umpires. It is not doing that. Wrong decisions
so
are still
the
happening.
Stuart
there
Broad
must be something wrong.
Was not a failure of the DRS system.
There was footage there that showed he was out of the DRS system.
The simple failure of the DRS system there was not anything to do with the system. It was a failure of the Australian captaincy, and that's a totally different thing.
Under a system
which allows you two referrals an innings, you are able to make two referrals an innings. Your inability to use those correctly is your fault. That has no issue to do with the system.
So two openers have incredibly marginal LB decisions that they both refer, and then they're both out, and then someone else, a number three, middles a ball to gully and it's not given out because they don't think it's an edge, therefore it's the fault of the captain. It's not. I mean, you can't.
The whole point. I guess.
So
part
it's become.
Of where
it
this
has become
feels.
Tactical.
Well, I was going to say that this is maybe where a lot of this debate.
Umpiring
actually,
should be up to the umpires, not up to the players. I think that's fundamental.
And umpiring still is up to the umpires.
No,
it
it's
is
not,
entirely
because,
up to the umpires
because they can't. Because the umpire at that point could not say, okay, it might look out. I can't. He couldn't refer that to the third umpire. So therefore, the umpires were completely disempowered to make the right decision.
Let's be clear. Like the Stuart Broad decision, in particular, why it struck so much is it was a terrible failing of on-field umpiring, aside from anything else. But I think this key point, and maybe this is where we really disagree, is that I'm very, very comfortable with this being a new skill set for captains to have, and I'm very comfortable with this idea that this is something you use. I'll tell you the other reason, but then
let's move away from saying that it is there to help the umpires and it is there to eliminate the bad decisions. It's not. It's there to be used tactically. Because the idea of giving it into the hands of the players is that if a batsman, you know, is given out LBW and he knows he's nicked it, the premise is that, you know, the batsman's sometimes going to know things that the umpire doesn't. Mm. And therefore, the batsman can give their input by referring it. But you get to a situation where now, you know, Chris Rogers never refers anything because Shane Watson always refers something. Mm. And then you get further down. So, in fact, it's turned into something that has got nothing to do with actually wanting to get to the right decision. It's got to the point of adding another test for the captain, which is exactly what
right,
you said.
And I've said I'm very, very comfortable with that. And I still feel what's being missed out here, and I think the problem really with the first two tests of this Ashes series, is they have been freak tests. You can go back to when England were in Australia last, and I would say the total DRS controversy in that series was less than what we've had in two tests here. And what you've had is a lot of freak incidents. And what you've had, perhaps more than that, actually, is incredibly poor use of the system. Because let's be clear on the fact that the number of times that a team uses two referrals and then an absolute sit, you know, an obvious blunder like the Stuart Broad incident comes up, this isn't the kind of day-to-day DRS system.
But what's the difference? But this point, why does it have to be an obvious blunder? Even if it had only been a tiny edge, that would have been just as bad as an obvious blunder.
No, because the point is, the capacity to have the right decision made was there. Michael Clark had that opportunity and wasted it.
The umpires had that opportunity because there was the television there and a hotspot and a snicker.
Okay,
the technology was there to get the decision right, but it couldn't be used. Let's go to your world.
If we allow, there's several practical reasons for this. If we allowed umpires to use technology the entire time, it would kill the skill of on-field umpiring in a stroke. Just to clarify that. The ability of an on-field umpire, which maybe, for a start, would go to stroke, but there's also a very key practical and boring, frankly, but important consideration here, which is that the game would suffer through the sheer quantity of referrals. There's actually an interesting parallel here in American football.
Well, actually, no, they wouldn't, because actually, for the things that aren't really, really marginal, for the things where they don't have to play it over, you know, do replays 50 times in order to see a hotspot, it's very clear on one replay for the TV umpire. You know, which is why they always check, in the Lord's test, they checked a lot of no balls when someone was, you know, caught behind or something. They checked a lot of no balls for the bowlers, and they could do that just while the batsman was standing there. They do it in 5 seconds, one replay, and it's there. I mean, I personally think we should get rid of DRS completely, but this is the debate. I personally think we should. But I think the point is that we have got to the stage where it is a ludicrous halfway house, where we have all the technology in place to make all the right decisions, and yet we only choose to use it some of the time.
We choose to use it when the captains who have that power judge it most appropriate to be used. And by doing it in that way, you keep the responsibility with the captains, you keep the power of the on-field umpires, and you also ensure that the game isn't excessively delayed by endless referrals.
I don't think you can keep power with umpires if it is captains who are deciding how the umpires are interacting with
the under the current system.
That's taking the power out of the umpires' hands. If the captains can go to the third umpires, but the umpires can't go to the third umpires, that is taking power out of the umpires' hands.
On the current system, the judgment made by the on-field umpires is still of relevance. It still matters. Any system which involves them being allowed infinite referrals and allows umpires the ability to set anything up kills that skill. It kills the credibility of that ability to make an on-the-spot decision. And I think that's something, personally, from a traditional perspective, I like DRS, but I like the fact that that old-fashioned, that old-school cricketing skill of being able to see an LBW and being able to see an edge and making a call on it is still of importance.
But fundamentally, you're missing the point that with all the DRS technology in place, it undermines the umpire if they don't give a Stuart Broad decision out. That undermines them. It doesn't give them power. It doesn't say that they're massively skilled. The umpires were ridiculed for being without skill
as was Michael Clark for his poor use of the system.
Yeah, that's fine. Michael Clark we can take down, but when we take the umpires down, then we really start degrading the game.
I mean, the point is, if you take the system out, you're not going to change that in the context that a bad decision is a bad decision.
No, but that's not what we're debating.
As you can see, we may struggle within the confines of what we hope is a relatively brief, succinct and concise and thoroughly entertaining podcast, we're unlikely to get to a conclusion on this.
So, if you have any thoughts on this burning issue, then let us know. We're over on Twitter at @ReverseSwept. We're going to carry on debating offline, so do join us over on Twitter, and thanks for listening.